as opposed to the UCs like UCLA, which has taken a lot longer to respond and is slower to respond because they're state schools. And so they are subject to constitutional limitations as state actors, right? So at UCLA, for example, or Berkeley or any of those schools, the administration has a difficult time because on one hand, they have rules about, where you can protest, how you can protest, that you can't interfere with people's access, egress and ingress, things like that. But on the other hand, they do have to give the right to free speech because these protesters have that right. And it's complicated, right? It's very, very complicated. So while I certainly believe what I believe, and I can tell you what that is, I think we all have to recognize how difficult it is for administrations right now, right? These are very difficult issues for administrators of all of the colleges. And I do not envy them this last couple of weeks. Having said that, I think that the speech that these protesters have engaged in has been in many places hate speech. So these are such critical issues in your world, and I would suggest to everybody that you have to stay very, very informed and really listen to the speech that's being uttered.
On that note, Marina Fragan, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Thank you so much for having me, John. Always an honor.
This is John Crumshaw for KPFK, Politics or Pedagogy.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Hello and welcome to Radio Intifada, a weekly review of politics and culture covering the whole region of South and West Asia and Northern Africa, produced by the Swana Region Radio Collective, that regularly broadcasts on Pacifica Station KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. My name is Soraya Zarouk, here with my co-host David Lloyd on behalf of the Swana Region Radio Collective. We thank our friends Esti Chandler and Nagwa Ibrahim at Middle East in Focus for allowing us to use their usual broadcast time for this Memorial Day broadcast today. Swana Region Radio can be found on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Anchor, Radio Public, and Breaker. You can also follow our updates on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We thank you in advance for sharing our podcasts widely.
So nearly 3 years ago today, the recently elected U.S. President Joe Biden brought the United States' 20-year occupation of Afghanistan to an abrupt and, in most views, chaotic end, leaving the Taliban to culminate its long guerrilla war with a complete takeover of the country. U.S. forces were withdrawn to the background of frantic scenes at Kabul's airport, where many who had worked for the United States, its allies and NGOs, and others who simply feared life under the Taliban, sought to flee the country. Almost 3 years later, Afghanistan has largely slipped from the headlines, displaced by the situation in Ukraine, the Israeli genocide in Gaza, or the indicted sex offender Donald Trump's courtroom antics. While Radio Intifada, too, has been focused on the situation in Palestine over the last months, this Memorial Weekend, as America celebrates its warriors fallen in a succession of imperial wars from the Philippines to Iraq, we turn to consider the situation now in Afghanistan, a nation devastated not only by the U.S.'s post-9/11 occupation, but by its prior engagement there in the wake of the Soviet invasion in 1979, in support of the then ruling communist government. U.S.-funded and armed mujahideen, welcomed to the White House as freedom fighters by then President Reagan, brought about the civil war in which the Taliban ultimately triumphed in the 1990s.
The Taliban's victory and seizure of power after the U.S. withdrawal in 2021 may have brought a period of constant warfare and U.S. drone warfare and bombing mostly to an end, bringing relative peace back to the war-torn nation, but it has also restored a notoriously conservative and repressive regime whose impact on political freedoms and especially the freedoms of women has been deep and devastating to Afghan civil society that historically had not been known for such repressive attitudes. The return of the Taliban has also meant the withdrawal or suppression of international NGOs, not least those engaged with the furtherance of women's rights, but also those aid organizations concerned with the day-to-day survival of the population. To compound the drastic situation for Afghan society, Taliban rule coincided with a long-lasting drought that has destroyed much of the country's agriculture and to which climate change has made the country especially vulnerable. In recent weeks, the drought has been punctuated by no less destructive flooding that has also affected its neighbor, Pakistan. According to Reuters, flash floods caused by heavy rains devastated villages in northern Afghanistan last week, killing 315 people and injuring more than 1,600. Since then, at least 50 more people have died following a fresh bout of heavy rain and flooding in central Afghanistan. Meanwhile, the U.S. and its allies continue to sequester Afghan treasure on the pretext of reserving it to compensate victims of the attacks of 9/11, for which the Afghan people were not in any way responsible and for which they have paid so intolerable a price for two decades.
So today we discuss the situation in Afghanistan with two guests, Malalai Farooqi Ramadan and Shah Mahmoud Hanifi, whom we last spoke with in our series of shows on the consequences of the US withdrawal in fall 2021, which you can still find on our podcast site at anchor.fm/swana. Having arrived in the United States as a refugee in the early 90s, Malalai Farooqi Ramadan has an intimate understanding of the dire situation in Afghanistan that is currently plaguing her country. Today, Malalai can be found in the courtroom working as a partner in the law offices of Michael Scafidi, one of Southern California's largest criminal defense firms. She's a graduate of the University of California, Irvine, and received her Juris Doctorate from the University of Laverne College of Law. You can find and follow Malalai on Instagram. She's published on the issue of Afghan children, and you can find her article, The Collateral Imprisonment of Afghan Children, an Obstacle to Building the Afghan State, in the Laverne Law Review. And Shah Mahmoud Hanifi is professor of history at James Madison University, where he teaches courses on the Middle East and South Asia. His publications have addressed subjects including colonial political economy, the Pashto language, photography, cartography, animal and environmental studies, and Orientalism in Afghanistan. Professor Hanifi's research has been supported by the American Historical Society, the Social Science Research Council, the Council of American Overseas Research Centers, the Asian Development Bank, and the Carnegie Corporation of New York. Welcome back to the show, Malalai and Shah Mahmoud.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Malalai, let's begin with you. Could you explain what the situation is for women and girls now in Afghanistan? The Taliban closed girls' schools and also denies the right to women to appear in public or public life independently, despite initial promises by the leadership to respect women's rights to education and enter professions like medicine. Is this picture correct? And how are women managing to maintain any kind of resistance?
I think one of the biggest issues is the way that the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan. I think that there was a complete lack of oversight that prevented any sort of transition at all from occurring that would focus on ensuring that the women who had been able to go to school to maintain their jobs, specifically those in government and anything else, would still be kept in line. I have family who still lives there, and I have family here in the U.S. that it visited. In fact, they're currently there now, and the situation is incredibly dire. Women that have been spending the last several decades working and earning degrees and doing jobs are now no longer to do any of those. Those lives essentially have ceased to exist for them. And any attempts made to be able to get back into the workforce have been met with incredible aversiveness from the Taliban. And it's become a safety issue. So at some point, you have to decide, do I keep continuing to resist and maintain any semblance of life that I had before this withdrawal occurred? Or, you know, do I just accept the status quo for the safety of my family and my children? And I think that's the present situation for a lot of these women. And sometimes what you hear in the Afghan community is, Afghans go back and they say, well, things don't seem so bad. And I think that's really easy to say as a tourist in your country. But when you're living there on a day-to-day basis and you understand that there's a complete lack of rights, It's not, you can't say that it's not so bad. It's incredibly depressing for somebody like me who's been here and who's afforded an opportunity to be able to work and do what I've wanted to do my whole life. And I spent the last 20 years going back several times, and my family members were working and they were getting their degrees. And for all that to be stripped away is very difficult to watch.
Gosh, that's such a terrible account of the situation. I'm curious, of course, about the fact that you have family there right now and how they're managing to be there under the present regime. But I did also want to ask you a little bit about regional differences. I mean, historically, there have been rural parts of the country that have been traditionally very controlling of women. But then there's also the urban situation in places like Kabul. And I'm wondering if those differences are being ironed out by Taliban repression, whether in fact, you know, rural customs and so forth are being brought to the city and being imposed upon people like you mentioned, who've been having degrees and participating in politics and so forth.
So my family is from Herat. Herat is considered to be a big city. It's not considered to be a rural area, though I'll bet it's a little more conservative, I think people would say, than Kabul. And we also have family in Kabul. And our experiences have been that there's really no difference between the treatment of these women in these cities and the women in the rural areas. That's been my experience in my conversations with family who live here, who've just been back, family who live there and have remained there, that they haven't really noticed a difference.
Right. So what are women doing in order to preserve some space of freedom and to navigate Taliban repression? I mean, are they able to sort of form independent secret schooling opportunities and things like that? Or is that even that now too dangerous to engage in?
So I know that there have been protests that have occurred. There's a lot of brave women leading those protests in an attempt to change. And those protests have been met with violence and with force and with arrests. And I don't think that that's deterred them. The Afghan society, Afghanistan, has always been a free society. And I know this is a conversation that we touched base on last time, is that we weren't a country that needed the West to liberate us. This is who we've been as a people our entire existence. And that's very much ingrained in who we are as a society. And so despite threats of, you know, violence and arrests and anything others more serious, these women are still protesting. The last thing I wanted to touch on was that there are some very brave women wanting to coordinate meetings with the Taliban government and with those in power. And they're going in there face to face and demanding that these rights. So I think that movement is very much still alive.
I wanted to ask about Human Rights Watch that has recently suggested that the Taliban might be taken to the International Court of Justice on charges of gender persecution, a crime against humanity, and possibly gender apartheid. As a lawyer, Malalai, how would you assess the prospects of this endeavor?
Well, there's the idealistic answer, and then there's, you know, the realistic answer that I have, which is something that I always tell my clients, is that I want the very best for you. And I think that you have a great case, but the criminal justice system is the criminal justice system. And so we have to work within the confines of that. And so while I think on paper and from a technical perspective and international law, which I've obviously not an expert in, as a disclaimer, that's not the kind of law that I do, from having a very basic minimum understanding, is that on paper, it looks great. But to be able to flesh these things out in court and in international criminal court, that's a different thing. But I'm hopeful.
You are listening to Radio Intifada on independent and listener-sponsored KPFK. I am Sarai Zarouk here with my co-host David Lloyd. We are here today with Malalai Farooqi Ramadan and Shah Mahmoud Hanifi to discuss the situation in Afghanistan.
Let me turn to the more general situation for the population. And of course, it's important to remember that women are an extremely important part of the Afghan economy at every single level. And of course, also as being primarily responsible for children and families and so forth, have a peculiarly important place in thinking about the economic situation. And given the withdrawal or closure of NGOs, many of which have worked in women's education and in other such projects, given also the US's withholding of Afghan monies, the isolation of the Taliban in diplomatic terms, the recent droughts, flooding, leading to famine and food shortages, nearly half the population are food insecure, including almost 3 million dangerously close to famine. And I'm just wondering, how are people managing at all to find ways to survive? And I wondered if I could turn to you first, Shah Mahmood Hanifi, as you've recently written on the question of water in Afghanistan. And I wondered if that would shed some light on conditions right now.
Well, thank you for noticing the water article, David. That's great. And I can't speak with any firsthand knowledge of really any place in Afghanistan. I can say, though, with regard to a couple of issues related to water, for example, the Taliban are pursuing the same kind of big ticket industrial hydrology projects that the U.S. government was known for, and not just in the last 20 years, but really since the late 1940s with the Helmand Valley project. So the Taliban, there's a major canal that's being inaugurated in the north. And so the point is, I think there's some continuity in terms of large scale industrial developments of water resources connected to transportation and railroad grids and things like that in particular sections. So the overall economic conditions, I think there's a couple of things going on here, that the distinctions within Afghan society between urban and rural or different urban sectors. Another way to look at this is through class. And, you know, there's still heavy, heavy concentrations of capital incoming into Kabul from different routes. It may not be sort of American direct flights, but it's still Turkey, the Gulf, and East Asia. And, you know, kind of if we measure the flow of capital through daily airline flights or whatever, we can see enduring connections, in particular for the Gulf, right? And the Taliban are rulers, but also a class of rulers. And the kinds of capital coordinations between Dubai and Kabul are still being excavated by investigative journalists in the Gulf. I mean, the overall economic conditions, I still think there are great disparities between political elites in particular, Kabul also, the gradations of wealth and poverty in Kabul are extreme. And, you know, so the point is, in terms of a food supply, Afghanistan is still a net importer of food. Historically, I'm trying to figure out, when did this happen? Historically, the place was exporting food all around, really, kind of fed the Mughal elites for centuries. And when did we begin importing our food? And it's in that sort of Cold War era, it appears to be, right? With Mexican dwarf wheat coming in with, you know, Morrison Knudsen and these kinds of corporate intrusions. So, you know, I think just kind of backtracking to some of the framing of this, you know, the U.S. end of empire in Afghanistan, you know, I don't know. Empires sort of have a long afterlife or something like that. And there's still, I think, the assassination of al-Zawahiri a few months after indicates there's still a covert presence. I think the British and Europeans are still sort of there in terms of an international aid delivering community. There are still hundreds, if not thousands, of UN workers across, I think, I don't know how many UN agencies are represented in the overall UN package or in Afghanistan in particular, but there's dozens, you know. So I'm not sure if there's been an end of empire or a withdrawal of the international aid community. And I think in all of these contexts, Kabul is the most kind of tangible reference point, but always kind of a misleading locus from which to deduce larger processes throughout the country. And, you know, I mean, I still think the form of state in Afghanistan is historically, structurally kind of a weak one. and the Taliban are sort of in that shell of a weak state, no matter what kind of posturing and public profile. So I'm not sure exactly how Taliban reach extends throughout all areas and districts of the country. But I think the model of governance, is kind of a different one, where the Taliban kind of bring the court to the people. The people don't go to the court. And that's, structurally an alternative, problematic model. Well, so I don't think I know enough about the economy.
Let me then ask Malalai, you mentioned that your family has been visiting, and I'm wondering if they're reporting back on what they're seeing in terms of how people are surviving and how people are making a living and so forth. And maybe when you said that they're saying it's not so bad, maybe in fact that is what they're perceiving.
I just want to, I guess, echo also that Shah Mahmood brought up a good point, which is when my family specifically visits, the focal points are always called one hot. And so I think that, like you said, that sometimes skews the ideas of really where the country is at from an economic standpoint or political standpoint, anything like that. And so I think when my family is at one, they're going to visit with the lens of Americans who are there for a short amount of time, which I said, right, they're tourists in their own country, and they're visiting people in these two separate cities, and they're not going into the rural areas 99% of the time. It's difficult to get there, and it's not always the safest to get there. So I find it that when Afghan Americans are going back home, we say, to visit, it's usually within these cities. So I'm not sure if they're the most accurate assessors of that. So when they say it's not so bad, I think perhaps maybe they're usually talking about from a security standpoint, which is it's not so bad for them to attend there and that they don't feel unsafe. And I think that's where their focus, and that's what they're implying when they say that. And that, to which my response is, well, of course, it's not going to be so bad for you. You're Americans visiting there with a temporary amount of time, So that's my caveat to that.
Right, right.
Just one quick thing on that, about the sort of, I don't want to say freedom of movement, really, but the roads are open, they are paved, there are sort of, it's not random checkpoints, still checkpoints, but let's just say in terms of commercial flows, there seems to be less impediments than under the American regime, where there was a real competing set of checkpoint manners, as it were. So but again, how that precisely affects market relations and economic traffic, I don't know.
Shah Mahmood,
Go ahead, Mala.
I was just going to say, though, that freedom of security and movement, though, unfortunately now, even though it's more open, only affects a certain group of people, right? So it's including an entire gender from that. So I think that's the difficulty. So I think if you speak to most of my male family members who visit, they'll say, we seem to be able to get around just fine. But that's because normally, historically, you've always been able to do that. So I think the real question would be, having somebody who's currently there as a woman be able to explain what these, differences and freedom of movement, as you said, are.
Thank you, Malalai, for reminding us of those nuances. Shah Mahmood, I'd like to discuss a little bit more the crisis in food supplies, which has been aggravated by the turn to various forms of cash crops. And so the widespread cultivation of opium poppies, for instance, has been suppressed in large part by the Taliban, but cash crops like cotton, which use high amounts of water, have apparently replaced it with no less harmful effects. Could you talk a little bit more about this?
Well, that's new. I'm not aware of that shift in commodity production. Thank you for making me aware of it. And I think that speaks to the dynamism and resilience of local agricultural producers, right? I think this indicates some ability to sort of recalibrate. And in that sense, that is indicative of a vibrant economy, or at least there's if you shift your niche, there's another niche to go to. It's not just the eradication of one and no livelihood. So I don't know where precisely, though, if it is in terms of historic patterns, the flow of that cotton would be to South Asia. That would be the markets of Pakistan. I would think we would need to check exactly if this is for sort of clothing production or what exactly, where is the processing of the cotton and the marketing of it. I'd want to follow the commodity trajectory of the cotton to answer that better. Makes a great research project, though.
We'll have you do that research project, Sharmak. I agree with you. It's very interesting. The other issue to do with the international situation is the ongoing expulsion of Afghan migrants from Iran and Pakistan that's been picking up over the last while. And Pakistan's announced it would deport all illegal foreigners last October. And between the middle of September and beginning of May, more than 500,000 Afghans were deported or returned to Afghanistan, according to the UN's Migration Agency. And currently, reports note that hundreds of Afghan migrants are arriving in the Afghan provinces of Kandahar and Nangarhar from Pakistan, many of whom have never even lived in Afghanistan. So, Manalai, I wondered, do you have any sense of what's going on here, why this drastic expulsion of Afghan refugees back into Afghanistan? Do you have any sense of how they're doing when they do get back, how they're being resettled?
I just want to touch base on a few things first. I don't have a specific idea of why the Pakistani government is electing to do this now, but I think the concern is the mode and method in which they're doing this, which is, like David, you said, some of these people have either never stepped foot into this country or they've created roots, have been working and living in Pakistan for like 20 plus years. And without an opportunity to be heard, and just as a background, it's incredibly difficult to be able to obtain legal documentation, citizenship, status, visa in Pakistan for these Afghans. The process is incredibly daunting and expensive and not easily granted. And so sometimes what ends up happening is that you can live there for decades and still not be able to have the rights that you should be afforded. And the method in which they're being deported is they're being picked up and there's no notice to family. There's no money that's being given to them, no opportunity to do anything. And then they're just taken across the border. And now they're being dropped in a country that, though is their motherland, they haven't had any opportunity to build roots in. And so I think that there needs to be some sort of oversight and work done. And the Pakistani government, you know, needs to be held accountable for that. And I believe that statements had been made that there has to be more oversight in the method in which they're doing this. And there needs to be a due process, standard here, which is not occurring. I have to leave it on a little bit, but the last thing I want to kind of talk about and bring attention to, and unfortunately I hate that I'm still talking about this, is that we still need to keep in mind that the Afghan Readjustment Act and these special immigrant visas are still an ongoing issue here with no resolution. And the only way for these Afghans who placed their lives on the line and have worked with the U.S. government and have supported them is to still seek asylum or these special immigrant visas. And it's taking up to 975 days for some of these to be granted and to be even reviewed. And in the interim, you're here or you're still there. And to seek asylum is an incredibly difficult process. It hadn't always been so. And over the years, this process has become more and more strict. And like we discussed at the last time I was on the show, the paperwork required most of the time for these processes were destroyed. And so now these people are starting from scratch. And I just want to bring attention to just incredibly how disheartening it is that this is still an issue. But I want to say as the last thing, thank you for having me on your show, is I want to commend organizations like the Afghan American Foundation and Women for Afghan Women who are assisting in getting these individuals to a place where they can perhaps get some movement. So I am appreciative of the Afghan American effort in the States to be able to assist.
Thank you, Malalai.
Thank you, David and Soraya. And it was so nice to meet you, Shah Mahmoud.
Nice to meet you, Malalai. Thank you for all your work in the larger courts that involve Afghans in particular, I hope.
are listening to Radio Intifada on independent and listener-sponsored KPFK. I am Sarai Zarouk here with my co-host David Lloyd. We are here today with Malalai Farooqi Ramadan and Shah Mahmoud Hanifi to discuss the situation in Afghanistan. Malalai unfortunately just had to leave us, but we will continue with Shah Mahmoud.
David, could I pick up on just a couple of things that Malalai left for us